Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, and welcome to another episode of Voices for Excellence. I'm your host, Dr. Michael Connor, CEO and founder of the Agile Evolutionary Group, and of course, the proud host of VFE. And today's guest is such an honor to have her on. One of the extraordinary educators across the country, has been in education for over 30 years. However, most recognized as the former commissioner of education for the state of New Jersey. Under her leadership, New Jersey was number one in the country with regards to performance and academic outcomes. She served, or are you still serving, Dr. Marcus, as the executive director for New Jersey AICD?
I am serving for one more month and then transitioning out. There will be a new leader coming.
So she is in that role, the executive director of New Jersey AICD, for one more month. And of course, we're going to talk about her own organization, Education Advisors. But it is such an honor to have one of the esteemed instructional leaders, executive leaders on VFE today. Without hesitation, it is so good to bring on Dr. Kimberly Harrington Marcus on VFE. Dr. Marcus, how are you today? Good morning. Such an honor to have you.
Good morning, Dr. Connor. I'm so excited to be here. It's just a great day when I get to start with a super conversation with a colleague around education, my favorite pastime.
Absolutely, Dr. Marcus. And again, I've admired your leadership for a very, very long time, specifically your work when you were Commissioner of Education for New Jersey. But I want to expand upon that, exactly what you did, the innovation work, bringing in AI at a time where it was very novel in education and also teacher effectiveness. So there's going to be a lot to cover, specifically with your organization and the work that you're doing now. But I want to get into a fun question, Dr. Marcus. Is that okay?
Hit me. Absolutely. I love a little fun first thing in the morning.
First thing in the morning, we're going to have some fun because this is going to give my viewers and my audience a deeper picture of who you are, because your work extends beyond 30 years in education. As I stated before, rising to the top, being the commissioner of education for the state of New Jersey. But what song, Dr. Marcus, what song would education stakeholders, leaders, politicians, educators across the country describe your leadership signature in the industry?
Yeah, well, that's a really interesting question, one I have not been asked. I actually particularly love this question because I am deeply passionate about the arts. I've played classical flute for 40 years, and I play the bass and sing. So going back in the song bank, trying to think about what might that be, it's tricky to think about it with what somebody might say about you versus what I might say about them. But I think two sort of oldies but goodies come to mind for me that I would hope people would say. I aspired for them to know that I believed in them. So the first song that I think of would be Try a Little Kindness by Glen Campbell. I think that for me resonates because of the lyrics specifically around shining your light for everyone to see. I really saw it as the commissioner to not only help people see the light that they were shining on students, but to for myself to shine that light on them as well. We created the Lighthouse District Initiative, which still continues on to this day, where we were celebrating districts doing amazing things for kids and not necessarily just at a proficiency-based level, but looking at growth as well as proficiency and other components, not just academic. And so for me, that really shining a light on best practices and places that are doing wonderful things for kids. I also, in the lyrics to that song, it talks about lending a hand. And I really saw that as my role was really how, you know, when you're leading in a bureaucratic space, you really have to think about how can you bring that personal touch and also how can you sort of remove the barrier of being, quote unquote, the state and really being seen as someone who is not only guiding the way, but also coming alongside. So for me, that really, how do you lend a hand? How do we do this work collaboratively? And how do you make sure that educators on behalf of students are having a voice in the conversations and decisions being made at the state level? And then I think lastly, the last lyric from that that really jumps out for me is showing kindness every day. I think I'm known on Twitter as at a gratitude girl, or X as we should say now. But gratitude has always been something near and dear to me. And so for me, really trying to show kindness and compassion to all of those interested parties across our state who are working with and serving children in their various capacities, showing them kindness and grace, and how can we do this really enormous work together and get our arms around kids. So I would say that's my song number one, and I'll pause before I tell you song number two.
No, this is great, Dr. Marcus. Try a little kindness. Now, the Lighthouse Initiative, I know, at the state, which you said is still continuing. We have seen that replicated across many states in the United States, where we had a previous guest, one of the authors or architects of the No Child Left Behind Act, Mr. Tom Vander Ark, and we were talking about, or he was talking about how the continuation of NCLB that got left out was that growth part, right? And
yeah,
I think
yeah,
efficiency versus growth, that was a core pillar on differentiating schools from being A schools to B schools, where it was just that absolute lens. But you're right, showing gratitude and lending a hand, I think we need to do more of creating those collaborative spaces in education, specifically on how we can cogitate on some of the biggest problems of practice that we're facing. And we're seeing now after COVID, these variables are compounding variables as well. But I think we need a little bit more kindness and compassion. But I can't wait to hear your second song.
All right. So my second song, this is, again, I'm sure that people, they might not pick the song, but I think the sentiments behind it would definitely resonate. So I am a huge music theater person as well. And, you know, I believe so strongly in the arts being a component of a child's journey from brain development to just various exposures. And it's where I found my people. So my second song is a Stephen Sondheim song from Into the Woods called Children Will Listen. And I think for me, as you know, student voice has been, that has been my greatest passion, my fiercest advocacy over the last 10 to 15 years now, really consistently. And so I think, you know, what I'm known for saying is that children are wonderful observers, but terrible interpreters. And so they see and they watch and they feel. And then without our guidance and modeling, they're left to their own interpretation. And that's not always correct. So, you know, I'm working with teachers about being careful when you're co-teaching in a classroom and you turn to whisper something. And it may be about the lesson. It may not be about a child, but a child may interpret that as they're being talked about. And then, you know, what does that mean? And what did they say about me? And do they like me? And do they believe in me? And pretty soon we're on a spiral where that message has become what a child has internalized, even if it was never what it was meant to be. So really modeling and thinking and being mindful that children are listening to everything that we say and watching everything that we do. And, you know, in the song and in the story of Into the Woods, it talks a lot about wishes and spells. And I think, you know, again, we have so much power as educators to shape and grow young minds and people and humans and really who can be change makers of our future. So I think really being careful about those wishes or spells that we put on children that might prejudge a space that impacts them for life, be it for the better or for the worse. So for me, that song is just incredibly powerful when we think about what children are doing and the role that we're playing.
Absolutely, Dr. Marcus. And you have been a steadfast advocate with regards to student voice in the classroom, in the learning organization, through different elements of the instructional model, operating model of education, which is critical. We're going to expand on that because I don't know if you know this, Dr. Marcus, but right now in education, right, when we look at the teacher population is dominated by millennials. We have two generations, whether in higher education or whether they're in the pre-K-12 sector, Generation Z and Generation Alpha, two generations that are fundamentally different, the antithesis of any generation of mankind. Why? Because Generation Z is they're the digital natives, and Generation Alpha, what we call the generative natives. Now, obviously, student voice in the context of teach and learn is going to have to be different because of the characteristics and the attributes of Generation Z, Generation Alpha. We'll get into that. But yes, children will listen. I love what you stated. Children are great observers, but need to work on their interpretation, and we have to be able to guide that interpretation through their voice. Want to be able to expand on that, but moving seamlessly into the second question, right? And I want to talk about your tenure as Commissioner of Education for the state of New Jersey. You saw the implementation of many innovative initiatives. Obviously, the initiatives have led to the output of being the number one performing state in the country for education in New Jersey. You worked on the quality of leadership and practitioner effectiveness, instructional coherence amongst the districts in New Jersey. Now, if you were Commissioner of Education today, in this new paradigm of what I call the AC stage of education after COVID-19, what would be your priority areas to reimagine education in New Jersey or any state if you were commissioner of, to be in alignment with the new demands regarding the future of work?
Great question. And I think I'll still go back to my foundation, which I believe is still the foundation. So when I was serving as New Jersey's commissioner, one of the tremendous works I was able to guide was the development of the social emotional learning competencies. That was done with a committee of just phenomenal leaders across the country and within New Jersey to develop those specifically for our students, but was very intentionally developed as competencies and not standards. Because what happens with standards is they get assigned to a 42-minute class period. They get siloed, and social emotional learning is something that has to be integrated across a child's entire day. And in my opinion, it is the foundation that everything else is built upon. So without it, it's very hard to layer on any other type of learning, you know, academic, physical, et cetera. So for me, I still believe that that's the foundation. And as we talk about a post COVID-19 world in education, I think that's even more at the forefront, as we have been talking so much about mental health and well-being, but also those attributes that a child needs to be able to be nimble and ready for the workforce. Because what we find is many of our students may have the content necessary for a career, but they're lacking those, whatever we want to call them, life skills, soft skills, 21st century skills. And so I think for me, that social emotional foundation is really essential coming out of the space that we've been in and as we look to the work frontier. If I was redesigning education, and I dream about this a lot for many, many years, I wanted to start my own school, and I actually wanted to start with a high school and work my way back to elementary, because I think so often in elementary, we understand the need for learning to be integrated, experiential, et cetera. But as we get older, as students get older, we silo and take away the things that they need most. So if I was redesigning education right now, I would have a huge focus on content in context, and really trying to think about how we can creatively move that needle in middle and high school spaces where we have so much siloing, and we have whole children moving through the day, and they're not thinking, okay, right now I'm a math student, right now I'm a history student. they're just a student and not even a student. They're them, right? I'm me. And I'm moving through this day and I'm trying to make sense of everything I'm learning and how it connects to me and to the world around me. That quintessential question that's asked from kindergarten through 12th grade and beyond, when will I ever use this again? We've got to be answering that question. Because that is the career forward movement. And if we're not answering that question for students, and not just verbally, but experientially, then we're not helping them to recognize the connection between this trajectory. School is not this separate place that exists. It's all part of our journey that leads us to the place that we hope to get to, whatever that may look like. And for, you know, today's students, that's going to be multiple careers and places to be in. So again, combining those foundational skills along with content into context, I think really prepares our students to be the types of learners and thinkers that will have very successful careers and be the change makers of our future.
Absolutely. And Dr. Harrington, Dr. Harrington Marcus, thank you for that, because the focus on mental health needs to be prioritized. I think Dr. Marcus is really needs to be invested, a strategic investment in education. Some alarming metrics to underscore your sentiments around SEL competencies. Thank you, shifting from competencies to standards. 40, and this is from the CDC that I most recently saw, 42% of high school students felt a level of hopelessness and sadness at some point during or after the pandemic. And moreover, which I think is more alarming, is that 22% of our high school students, this is from the CDC, had suicidal thoughts during and post-pandemic. So we're looking at these alarming numbers as well. There needs to be a strategic investment. And I love that you said that this is your foundation, is to be able to expand on these SEL competencies with an intentional focus on the well-being of our students. And I think that needs to be prioritized now with these alarming metrics, multiple metrics that I've been unpacking from the CDC and other specific data source areas. But content and context, I want to be able to have you expand on that. Because when you hear kids, and you made a statement that resonates with me, that still I hear today with students, is when will I use this again, right? And when I look at the historical structures of education, and we would have to shift those middle and high school structures from being, you know, a time frame, 42, 48 minutes per period. This is just exclusively a linear English class, a history class, a math class, which you contextualize. How do we now, and this is a sub-question to the initial question before, how do we now start deconstructing those legacy structures that I think creates or exacerbate these insidious gaps, even from our students that want to move beyond the quote-unquote standards that they already mastered in hypothetically, let's say, 2 or 3 months? But how do we start moving away from those structures to start developing or focus content and curricula around competencies, so that now when students ask that essential question, when will I be able to use this and how will I be able to use this in society, they'll be able to know and articulate how they're using those competencies and skills. But again, we have to look at the system. How do we start deconstructing those structures to facilitate students having this, okay, I know when I'll use these competencies or skills again?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a huge job. and, you know, I'm one who, it's all about what's the baby step, what's the first step, because that's often the hardest to take. And I think what can happen is we get into this space where we're reimagining. And because we go so big, or we know that this system has been in place for so long, and there are so many components that are interwoven and interconnected, that so if we move one piece, we always have to make sure we're not harming children inadvertently as we make that decision. You know, as we move one piece, it's sort of like Jenga. Will it stay stable or will it fall? And I think sometimes A, the enormity of that large amount of work can cause us to just not do anything, and also the fear of what we might of the repercussions. So I think two things. One is, what can we do right now? So looking at even just expectations within a classroom, looking at a high school and having time and or the expectation that teachers across disciplines will plan and or work together to either do a project or something that helps students to make those connections across disciplines, or also even just making those seed plant mentions of how knowing what somebody else is doing, not just what's happening in your own classroom, but what's happening for your children, whether they're sophomores or seniors or whatever across their day, so that we're making those intentional connections and helping them to start to make those connections in their own minds. Those are just like baby step kinds of things. We have a lot of schools exploring competency-based learning. I think one of the greatest first steps we could also take is we silo so much in the K-12 and then the higher ed space. So how do we bring together? Think tanks can be sort of dangerous places sometimes because we love to talk and think and reimagine, but what action comes out of it is really important. So when I think about what does it look like for the K-12 space and higher ed spaces to get together and sort of be articulating and co-planning, because, just like that Jenga game analogy again, if I pull a block in K-12 by reimagining something, but higher ed isn't pulling the same block or doesn't have the next move to support it, then what happens to a child whose credentials or resume when they go to apply to colleges and a college doesn't recognize those sort of creative courses or different grading systems? So again, it's a delicate dance, but I think communication and, really having intentional conversations with action step oriented spacing, we can begin to remove the blocks and really begin then to take on a bigger system approach. But I think anytime we go after the system as a whole, we tend to shut down just recognizing that the work is too overwhelming or too large. And so, what is that bite-sized piece that allows us to start to shift, make those little shifts?
Dr. Marcus, great point, right? Communication, internal conversation, and action steps that lead to these bite-sized changes. I always like to say systems redesign or system shifting is a large body of work scaled into parts and prototype interchange, exactly what you stated. But when we talk about these shifts and structures, these shifts and systems, we have to recognize who's in our classroom, right? Generation Z and Generation Alpha. And this is included higher education as well. But throughout your leadership and your leadership trajectory, Dr. Marcus, you have advocated, we have known from years before Student Voice was Student Voice in
That's
education.
right.
You were advocating for this. And because voice and agency are priority demands now for Generation Z and Generation Alpha, you're one of the experts for Student Voice, right? What are some innovative and creative strategies right now, taking into consideration the attributes and dispositions of Generation Z and Generation Alpha? What are those strategies, those creative and innovative strategies to lament truly, authentically, student voice in every thread of the instructional and operating model in education?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's multifaceted, of course. And I think all generations, but particularly generations Alpha and Z, students are looking for belonging and purpose. And we see that more and more, from little ones, but especially starting into the middle school years, but definitely in the high school years. And what we often interpret as a checked out student or somebody who's disengaged is really just a student who's looking to find where do I belong and what is my purpose? And so I think for me, student voice has been such a passion of mine because I truly believe, like I believe in social emotional learning as the foundation for all learning success. I believe that student voice is truly the game changer that will shift education. And students have to be involved literally and figuratively in every conversation, and every consideration that's being made in education. I think adults do a lot of talking about how students learn, how what they need, what they like, but very rarely are we asking them. And so, you know, when I think about the power, especially with our current generations, you know, every generation has sought change and to have a voice. We've seen, you know, the protests, we've seen sit-ins, we've seen, you know, all the demonstrations over the years by different generations, but today's generation is demanding to be heard. And
yes,
they
sir.
have technology in a way that we didn't. And so it's super exciting for me because I feel like of all the times in history, I feel like they are being heard. And so I feel like it's really our duty to teach students how to have voice. And that's not just how to speak, right? It's knowing your audience. It's what is your why? What do you hope to get out of this? Like, what are you pushing towards? And how do you stand with facts behind you, but also bring the power of your passion as well? And so, you know, when I look across, I think, A, we have to be really intentionally teaching voice. And I think we've tried to do this in the English classroom for many years. But again, it's to me, it's so much more than just writing and speaking. And we need, just like we need that experiential learning, and students need those practices of being able to utilize their voice. And I'll share a very specific example of where I think some revolutionary change is taking place in a second. But, you know, where I'm seeing at the district sort of level, some of these places, we see principal and or superintendent student advisory councils. And I think that's a great go-to. The next shift I'd like to see there is that it's not just our honor society and or our top students, because we got to be hearing all voices. And, you know, we're not getting, we have significant blind spots when we don't round out a team with various perspectives. And that's true of students as well. So if we're not bringing in a student who appears to be a behavior issue or have chronic absenteeism or, you know, very quiet, we're not getting those different student perspectives involved. We as leaders have a very significant blind spot then, because we're only being guided by our most successful students who may come from a place of privilege or have a different work ethic, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, I've seen some really creative uses of those councils, though, in terms of doing planning, looking at renovations or building redesign. You know, one superintendent was sharing with me that she was redoing a building, a middle school, and she did have her student advisory council, and she went to them with like, here's the color design, here's whatever. And they were like, oh my gosh, you can't paint our school that color, those colors in the hallway. And so, but she listened. And, you know, I think we have to show and guide again that we are listening. But students are going to demand a different type of education. They already are. And we're going to see that become, I think, really impactful if we don't get out of our own way and trying to impose our world or the way we learned things onto students and really embrace where they are. So my specific example is I have the privilege of working with one of our universities here in New Jersey, and we're standing up a new general education college within the university, and it's all place and space based. And one of the things we notice, we have a very high percentage, and not just in New Jersey, but in many of our institutions of higher education, of first generation students who time and money are really essential. They're essential for all students, but particularly our first generation students. And what often happens in our general education courses is that if a child chooses, takes their science course because they're an education major, but then goes into engineering, now I have to take a different gen ed science course, which is time and money for me. And so in this new college that we're standing up, all the courses, gen ed courses for the first 2 years are transferable across all majors so that kids aren't losing that. But instead of, so this goes back to the voice question, because instead of doing a water study in a science lab, I'm going out into the community and I'm doing that water study in the community. And then instead of presenting a hypothetical presentation to my class about what I found, I'm going and meeting with town officials and I'm talking to them about what I've discovered and being able to ask questions and learn again to use my voice in a very different way, not just standing and delivering in front of an audience that doesn't have the expertise or ask me interactive questions like I would experience in the workspace. And then also the other thing that we're doing is that we are creating a series of minors, but they have to be cross-college or cross-discipline, because what we're seeing is we're seeing students who are interested in a variety of careers, and they're going to experience those things, but we still have our colleges siloed by categories that have existed for a long, long time. And so how do we start to offer students opportunities to create these really niche spaces they're looking for in terms of innovation and entrepreneurial spots? And then finally, in that work that we've been doing, we have students on that committee. And so they had recommended that they wanted to see a passion project be the final sort of pinnacle of those 2 years of study rather than just an exam. They want to be able to be developing out something that they're really passionate about and taking those different experiments and things that they're doing and tying them into a larger project that becomes a portfolio for them. So sorry, that's long-winded, but just,
Dr. Marcus,
really important student voice.
Where is this college at, Dr. Marcus? Because again, this is that type of educational experience, Dr. Marcus, that is rooted with the voices of our students, even at the higher education level, to be able to redesign and transform some of the historical original nodes of higher education to now being authentic. I love that you said moving from the hypothetical to the lived application. Where is this at? Because I think that this needs to be the normal, it needs to be normalized, or the normalization in education, PK through 20.
Yeah, so this is Kane University, and it's under the incredible visionary leadership of Dr. Repelette and Dr. Birdsell, who is the provost, Dr. Repelette, the president, who was my predecessor as a commissioner. And we are finding that we have been doing some presenting at various national conferences, and people are really leaning in, you know. And again, it goes back to that question you asked about how do you create systemic change? And so it's really like, how are we looking at what high schools are offering students and the experiences they're bringing to them? And then how can we bring that into higher ed? Because higher ed's numbers are dropping for all kinds of reasons. But, you know, if, again, students are demanding a different type of education, and if they're going to have some really creative, innovative experiences in high school, and then move into a higher ed setting where they feel stagnated, and then there is no purpose for them, they're going to just opt out and go a different direction. And in the society and world we're living in today, that's a possibility to be successful. So how are we reinventing our spaces to make them really meaningful and life-changing for students?
That is such a great answer, Dr. Marcus. And I say this every episode. I encourage my audience and my listeners to use this as an asynchronous mechanism of professional learning, and how you unwrapped student voice in a contextual form, as well as isolated strategies that can be interfaced together. To my audience, please rewind that answer, because Dr. Marcus highlighted how student voice can be intentionally elevated into the academic institution, if this is higher education, and then also the traditional PK through 12 model. One of the things that I really, really, really loved, Dr. Marcus, is to teach students how to have voice. I think we've been stating that we want to, or encouraging, or moving towards more student voice, more agency amongst Generation Z and Generation Alpha. But I think you contextualize it perfectly, is that we need to be able to teach students how to use their voice, defining agency and what agency is amongst with them. But Kane University is very lucky. I mean, you got Dr. Marcus and Dr. Repelette. Wow. Back-to-back commissioners at Kane University. Oh, man. Lamont Repelette, love him to death. Shout out to him as well. I want to go to Kane. I want to go to Kane University now with you and Dr. Repelette there. And then also there's Dr. Gray, Sancha Gray, that is there.
Yes. Oh, my gosh. It's an amazing. And Dr. Salvatore, Michael Salvatore is there. I mean, it's a really tremendous, powerful team there. Yeah. I wanted to say one other quick thing, because I think voice in general, I don't want to lose that spot, because when we talk about these different generations, there's one other space that I just want to seed plant. It's a whole nother conversation. It doesn't have to be today, but also for the listeners to really be thinking, especially if you're listening in and you're a leader in a district or in a higher education space, we have to be thinking about our teachers and the places that we're giving them voice as well, because I think in education, we know and we are recognizing that our students are going to hold a variety of careers, you know, potentially 10 to 15 different jobs. It's not going to be like myself where, you know, I was a lifer. In fact, I do a whole series of talks on I'm not a lifer like you, Mom, about my son, and I'll talk about him in a minute. But, you know, I think we recognize that that's going to be a changing space. But I think in education, we sort of stuck our heads in the sand to think that it's not going to affect us or happen to us, that we're still going to have lifers as teachers. And our teachers, our newest teachers, are still in those generations where they have lots of different things they want to do and explore. And so, you know, we don't have a pension system that's going to keep them. We don't have the variety of it's not about the money for them so much as really wanting to feel like they're doing meaningful work and that they are making a difference. And so how are we thinking about today's teachers in this same voice and making a different space in terms of how are we keeping them, you know, as long as we possibly can, but also what are we putting into place to be ready for that changing world that we're going to experience too, not just the business work space.
Absolutely. No, thank you, Dr. Marcus, for that very, very profound. And this kind of segues right into the next question, expanding on student voice. And you were recognized in the BC stage of education. I like to say before. I have all these time ecology, Kim, you know how
I love it. Hey, acronyms are it in education.
Acronyms soup, right? But yes. You awarded the EdTech Hero Award. Now, this was before, I like to say now, AI. Everybody is talking about AI, machine learning, different digital and emergent technologies, generative platforms. So everybody's talking about that. But before that, you were awarded the EdTech Hero Award. Now, with everything that I stated, AI, machine learning, generative platforms, they're revolutionizing the education model for new value capture. But what are the critical elements, Dr. Marcus, that needs to shift governance and policy structures to support these economic shifts in education? That's the first part. And then the second, how can learning organizations leverage these new advancements with AI, with generative platforms to create relevant learning experiences for Generation Z and Generation Alpha?
Yeah, I mean, this is a beast to tackle, right? This is a central conversation that's happening everywhere right now, particularly in the education space, but we're also seeing it all over. You know, we're seeing it in the copyright space, we're seeing it in the arts, we're seeing it in the job and the work space, and really having these conversations, it comes back, I think, again, to communication and really being open to talking about conversations, and particularly in the education space. I revisit, and again, this dates me, but the scientific calculator, taboo of, oh my goodness, like we're going to be able to use a calculator that's going to help us with formulas, and we can't possibly let our students do that, to the internet boom. You know, and that fear of like, what are we going to allow? How do we harness it? And again, I think a lot of times the limitations in our own adult minds prevent us from opening a world that is natural or, just the native space for our students. And what is that fine line between embracing and protecting? You know, how do we make sure that we are preparing our students and not preventing our students from moving ahead? And I think, you know, it's a delicate dance, because when, you know, AI is not new. We've been using it for our music, for searching, for a lot of different things. But the capacity, I really do feel like we're just seeing the tip of the iceberg right now. I think there's an intentional reveal happening, because we're needing that time to adjust to any shift in technology like we saw with the internet or other spaces. So I really believe the capabilities far exceed what we're even imagining right now. But I think of so many different, again, this is the student voice space. Let's be asking our students, like, how do they see themselves using it? What are they curious about? How are they using it already, right? You know, if we're going to say don't, they're going to go ahead and do. So we have to be thinking about the embrace. And so I sort of think of this years ago, you know, I was really passionately looking at the vo-tech space that I felt was sort of slipping away and or becoming, we were losing the focus on the intent to help students have career exploration and not just these elite academies or what have you. And so, you know, the trades are incredibly important and we need to be thinking about how we're allowing and fostering those spaces. So I think of like a traditional automotive program, right? Where a student is fascinated with cars or engines. A lot of that is engineering, but how do we move from teaching students how to go under the car and change the oil to how do we teach them to partner with robots, you know, and or AI to have a successful career in the automotive industry? And so I use that example to help us segue into a conversation around AI, because I think one of the biggest fears around AI is that it will take over. And I think there will be jobs or places where AI will have be able to do something faster or more effectively. But I was recently at an institute with the Education Research and Development Institute, ERDI, and we were having this very conversation. And we really came down to what we're calling HAIH, which is human, AI, human. And I think that could be a game changer, even in just getting our minds to have a different conversation around AI, because there is a human component and there always will be a human component. And so how is that a collaborative space? And I said I was going to talk a little bit about my son. So I just like to give concrete examples about how I think this is being used effectively. So my son is a high school English teacher, my oldest son. And he is firmly embracing AI in his English classroom. And this is a space where there's a lot of debate about AI, right? Because of citations and, you know, what is an original work. And so what he's done is he's shifted from a product-focused outcome to process. And he's using AI as almost a co-teacher or an intern. So rather than having his students peer edit, where we all know, I don't even have to say more, what happens in a peer editing situation, oftentimes a student is getting false information or changing things that might have been great or being misled and or losing the integrity of their own work. So he's using it. The students are peer editing with AI. And he's taught them how to use that and how to look at that you're not allowed to come to me for the teacher conference and have a cut and paste version of what you got from AI, whether you're using Grammarly or ChatGPT or any of the other engines that are out there, being able to take what AI gives you and then really digest and look at okay, what's a further prompt that I can ask? And then how do I question this? What's the next question I ask? Or how do I take this and put it into my own language? And so I think that that's, you know, really the place and space, but also understanding that with an intern or a student teacher, you're never going to just accept that work without looking at it and taking into account and asking questions. So I think as we bring it into the classroom in a variety of different ways or into education, we have to sort of have that mindset of AI as the intern. And so while it can give us great advice, we also need to do our due diligence to ask questions. And then lastly, when I think of, you know, he's also using it for planning development, slide development, emails, you know, a variety of things for his own self. But, you know, when we think about that governance and policy space, I think we really have to be, again, rethinking so many of our policies, especially around technology, often come from the negative. And so, you know, when a student receives, let's say, an acceptable use policy, it's coming from the don't, you know, and that's human nature is to just do the opposite. And so what would happen if we reconfigured those acceptable use policies? Do we want a policy? Do we have a policy around AI that is, in concrete, set in stone. In some districts, yes, but many districts are choosing not to make a specific policy, but really to be talking through it as a tool and how are we utilizing it and setting some guide rails around that, developing committees and having that work. But what if we approach those policy developments from a positive, from a proactive space, to be talking about how do we create the best digital citizens and change makers for the future by encouraging healthy and safe use of these tools. So sort of wandered around there, but I think that, you know, it's a really exciting place and it's here and it's going to stay here. So I really believe we have to figure out, again, how are we inviting students into the conversation? How are we empowering them? And how are we keeping them safe as we navigate? And I think it's hardest for educators because it's a, you know, we are immigrants to that world.
Yeah. No, I love how you stated that AI is not new. I started to think about the definition of AI when it first came out, 1956 by John McCarthy. And AI was given its name at Dartmouth College. I believe it was 1950. I'm trying to recite off rote memorization, Dr. Marcus, but I know John McCarthy gave the first definition of AI in 1956. So obviously, yes, we know that it has been around for a while. And this whole takeover, right? I think that this is an egregious misnomer, or I should say misinterpretation of what of the future with AI. One of my professors at Harvard, Kareem Akhani, he masterfully stated this quote that AI won't take over humans. It's humans with AI that will take over humans without AI. And the way that it's done is underscoring AI in the classroom is so meticulously articulated and implemented. I mean, if you look at both from his aspect of being a classroom practitioner and the students, the level of efficiency, right, has just increased exponentially. Your son is given his students a voice, an interaction between the AI, where now the AI is actually, like you say, acting as a student teacher, a guide on the side for students where it can be. You highlighted a point that I think is very critical is that you gave this example how technical skills need to interface with these digital skills, because we know that because of automation, the Oxford study stated that by I believe 2035, 47% of jobs are going to be automated. So yep. That really takes out the knowledge-based work or knowledge-grounded work in these industries where we're looking at digital and technical skills need to be interfaced with one another. And that's why there's this focus on development competencies and skills with our students, as opposed to just mastering specific standards. Well stated. And again, vocational education, where do you see that in the AC state of education, Dr. Marcus?
I mean, I think it's quintessential. I've thought that forever. I think, you know, again, when we talk about content in context, I think our vocational spaces, many of them have really embraced and get that students need to role play and to experience education in ways that help them envision who they might be and where their strengths are and where their interests lie. Okay. And I think, you know, I think we have to revisit and we constantly want to have these or spaces in education. And I think we've got to have the and spaces and we've got to stop being intimidated by, you know, I'm a traditional school, right. I'm a vocational school, I'm whatever. Right. We've got to be like, what are the things that are working and how do we capitalize on those for students? And we're seeing now across the country some of these sort of business models popping up where students are going to, it's almost like an apprenticeship model, but where they're taking courses in a business building type of corporate building setting where they are taking their courses, but also, you know, learning in the job-like setting that they are looking forward to. And I think, you know, when we look at like academy models where students come in and they put on scrubs and a stethoscope around their neck and they're learning science, you know, with in a lab setting, they're envisioning and seeing themselves in that new space.
Absolutely. And Dr. Marcus, I'm a huge proponent. I mean, I wrote a book about it, right?
Yes, of course. Exactly.
We need to have a disruptive education model.
Yes.
Students have experiences like that in industry-based jobs that they're going to be matriculating in. I find it fascinating, Dr. Marcus, that I'm seeing 18, 19-year-olds making $115,000, $120,000 right out of high school with certificates that they obtained.
That's right.
And therefore, I mean, that's great, marvelous. I can tell you this, Dr. Marcus, when I started as a first-year teacher making $33,000, I thought I was rich.
Well, let me tell you, I started at $19,000 and thought I was rich. So
everybody remembers their first
year
salary. But so true. And it's good to hear superintendents, Dr. Marcus, talk about how they're going to or how they're examining different approaches to integrate AI and machine learning into the VoTech experience, because now they're knowing that there's going to be synergy within these various VoTech areas, that now AI is going to be playing a critical role in that. But I like to reference, Dr. Marcus, this exploited version of VUCA. Now, we know what VUCA is: volatile, uncertain, complex, and ambiguous, right? But I read this book, Dr. Marcus, last year, where it was this exploited version of VUCA, which they called Unvice. Uncertain, volatile, there's a level of intersectionality, complex, and exponential. This is the 2.0 version of VUCA. We got all these acronyms, 1.0, 2.0, right? Exploited. But now, with the concept for level setting purposes, Dr. Marcus, of Unvice, right? How do we continue the work to be more strategic, albeit urgent, while understanding we are living in an educational world rooted in not VUCA, but Unvice?
Yeah, you know, I'm going to revisit our conversation we had around systems, because I think that human nature gets bogged down in the barriers. And so when I think of Unvice and I dissect that into pieces, I see lots of opportunity within that. But I think many people would see lots of barriers, and our defense mechanisms, as I said before, when we look at like trying to break down a system, our defense mechanisms immobilize us, right? And so we don't do anything. And I think that there is such an urgency that we have to take on these barriers. And I say urgency because our kids, like, we've been talking forever about 21st century learning. Well, we're there. Like, you know, we have got to get out of our own way. And that's really hard to do, but we have to be meeting our students where they are, not just as learners, but the world that they're living in and that they will work in and create families and be citizens of. And so for me, I think we're already behind as a system in education for our students. And there's such an urgency to get up to speed. And so I'm going to give a really super simple analogy that I use all the time, because I think it's powerful in helping us to sort of maybe break this barrier of being fixed or immobilized. And so I think of it as having a wand versus a video game controller. So I think we do a lot of wand waving. So especially when we look at the different components of Unvice, we think like, if only I could XYZ, and we wave the wand. But then when we wave the wand and we say, if only I could XYZ, those things that we come up with are often intangible in the moment, or something that we don't have enough power around or control over. And so because we can't do XYZ with the wand, we stop and we shift our focus, or we go back to something that we're already doing or that is our comfort zone that we know how to do, versus we have a video game controller in our hand every single day at every single moment. And so what are the things that are within our control that we really can take on? And so, you know, I think when we can plan and take action, instead of investing all this time and energy into waving a wand that doesn't have any power in it, we have to be able to really get into focus of What are those things we can take control over? Because I believe that there's a tremendous amount that we can, and that when we are embracing and quieting the noise, I think is another huge, huge problem right now, because there's so much focus on education and, you know, all the rumblings and the politics that are coming into play and pressures on superintendents from boards, et cetera, parent communities. But, you know, how do we quiet the noise? How do we look at what's best, first and foremost, always for children? Again, going back to that game changer in education, when every conversation literally or figuratively starts with students. It's not my lesson plans. They're the plans for the students. They're not my grades. They're the measures of success for our students. It's not my building or my new principal, but the principal who's going to serve our students. Those are revolutionary, game-changing conversations. And I think when we attack Unvice with that video game controller, I think we can make a huge difference. The other thing for me that I think is incredibly powerful when we're in these spaces that seem to have insurmountable barriers or obstacles is to really use storytelling to our advantage. Because when we're clear about our why and the students that we serve and the futures we're trying to help them create and the change that they'll make in this world, I really have such huge hope for our future with our current generation of students. But when we use storytelling, we can navigate some of these difficult waters or some of these tricky conversations. Because, you know, of course, we know as soon as we call out a particular word or that's a hot spot, we lose our voice, we lose our space in the conversation. And so by using storytelling and keeping the focus on the students, on the why, we really have tremendous power to, I think, not only make a difference as educators, but as a community, you know, bringing in business, bringing in community and parents. But when we are telling a story and we all are seeing our place as fabrics or threads in that tapestry of the story, I think we break down a lot of these barriers and allow for that momentum that is so urgently needed right now.
Yeah, Dr. Marcus, I love what you stated, that we need to move beyond the wand waving and for us to really, like a video game and a controller, taking control of what we can take control of. Very important. I like it, and I loved how you framed it. I would kind of put in this two-part phenomenon of VUCA is like the 21st century and Unvice is like the 22nd century. Mm-hmm. But so important that leaders need to storytell the why, right? And I think that we need to go deeper, double down with storytelling around the vision and eliminating the noise and focusing on the signals, storytelling the signals and articulating the why so that we can be able to achieve the vision of the 22nd century. You perfectly framed it. Basically, the 21st century is over. We need to start preparing our kids for the 22nd century. And I think that now, you know, as we're making these shifts to incorporating student voice agency, with an intentional manner, looking at AI in a variety of different ways, especially how we're implementing it for coherence. And then this lexicon around 22nd century is very, very critical in today's AC stage. But Dr. Marcus, last question. You made it through. I'm telling you. Everybody, you know, and Dr. Marcus, everybody.
The marathon.
Exactly. When I, previous guests, multiple guests, they would call me afterwards and they're like, Mike, this is harder than my superintendent interview, these questions. I'm like, this is supposed to be rigorous, but this is the only time, Dr. Marcus, I'm going to limit you to only three words, right? I know that you can speak a lot. I know that you gave a lot of great nuggets and strategies today, but for this question, I'm gonna limit you to three words. Now, a lot of my guests don't listen. They go on and extend, but I try to frame it. So I'd say it's semi-structured. But last question, Dr. Marcus, what three words do you want our audience to leave today's podcast with regarding intentional and bold leadership in the AC stage of education?
Okay, so my three words are courage, gratitude, and voice.
That's it? You're a rule follower?
You told me. I am definitely a rule follower. Although, in order to really make change in education, you have to be a little bit of a rebel. But yeah, you told me three words. I could
Only
expand on them, but courage, gratitude, voice.
I for my audience, because they have you on, I know I'm breaking my own rules. Can you expand on those three words?
Absolutely. I'll do it quickly, though. So courage is the courage to reinvent, walk a new path, navigate the changing landscape, figure out ways, creative ways to use the video game controller to get to that wand moment. Gratitude, I am so incredibly grateful to every educator who's listening in, who's in their schools and districts now, who's anywhere across our world, who's serving students. I'm full of gratitude, but I believe that finding morsels of gratitude daily can help us to deal with those really challenging or negative or low times, but it also helps us model for students the power of gratitude. And lastly, voice. I've spoken about this over and over again. Voice for all interested parties, students, educators, staff, parents, community, business. We have to listen and we have to collaborate.
Absolutely. Now I can be able to follow up. Courage, gratitude, and voice. I could just let you, Dr. Marcus, only leave us with three words, right? I would be a bigger rebel, but you are a rule follower. Dr. Marcus, thank you so much for coming on BFB. Any of my audience that want to be able to reach out to you, contact with you, expand on some of your answers and sentiments that you provided on the podcast, how would they be able to reach out to you?
Yeah, so they can reach out to me at K Marcus, M as in Mary, ARKUS, at Education Advisors LLC.com. And certainly, if that doesn't work for you, they can reach out to you or I can give you an email and or cell phone. Oh, and they can also find me on LinkedIn. That's an easy place to find me, is on LinkedIn. And then I'm happy to connect in any way and to support your journey or be a thought partner in any way. Thank you so much, Dr. Connor, for having me. It's just truly been an honor and what a pleasure to start a day with a fun, challenging conversation about the thing I love the most.
Absolutely. And Dr. Marcus, thank you for appearing. It's such an honor to have you. Hopefully, I'll be able to see you soon somewhere. I'll be in New Jersey
Yes.
in July.
Great.
So,
Oh, please let me know.
it's the big administrator superintendents conference that is, I believe, is going to be on the shore. So, I will be there. I'm actually keynoting the event. So, I'm looking
Nice.
forward to it. So I'll get to see all of my New Jersey friends. Shout out
Yes.
to New Jersey. There we go. But Dr. Marcus, thank you so much. And looking forward to staying in touch with you, following your work, and especially your work with education advisors, what you're doing within your corporation and company to elevate the voices of women leadership in education. Much needed. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And on that note, onward and upward, everybody. Have a great evening.